Welcome to Below the Surface at the Now, where we skip the small talk and dive deep into who you are, how you got here, and where you're going. I'm your host, Sarah O'Brien Hammond, and my mission is for you to heal, expand, and learn through the power of storytelling. Each week, we invite a beautiful soul to take us along their journey. Their insight, perspective, and knowledge allows us to find a deeper connection to ourselves and those around us. Simply listening truly has the power to change the world. You can find more information about this beautiful community at thenownyc.com. And if you love what you hear, please don't forget to rate and review this podcast. Now, let's take a deep breath, exhale, and get ready to dive deep. Melissa Lowenstein is a psychotherapist, parent coach, educational nonprofit administrator, group facilitator, writer, editor, creative artist, parent, step-parent, yoga, and somatics teacher practitioner. She's also a psychological astrologer. Let's dive deep and learn more about Melissa. Welcome back to Below the Surface at the Now. I am so thrilled that you have decided to join us for another thought-provoking, always informative, and I am pretty sure this will be pretty fun, conversation with our next guest. Today, we welcome Melissa Lowenstein to Below the Surface at the Now. Hello, Melissa.
Hello.
Good to have you. We just did our shakes. We both really appreciate a good shakes. We just shook our bodies to get ready for this conversation, and I'm really excited. Melissa was recently introduced to me by a fellow friend and member of the Network of Women. And I'm so grateful that we're introduced, and I'm excited for you to share your story with us, Melissa. So when you think, as I mentioned before, the only one consistent question I ask all my guests and where we kick off the conversation is, when you think about your earliest influence, environments, and people that have contributed to who you are and the paths that you've taken in life and where you are standing today, where do you go? Where does your mind go when asked that question?
The word earliest trips me up a little bit. I am a Capricorn and we are late bloomers. So a lot of the really important influences I think that have shaped what I'm up to now, I didn't really find them until I was in my 30s or 40s. My early life was kind of unremarkable. Like I had lovely parents who were loving and kind, and I had, you know, there was no financial lack. It was, you know, like I had a really nice upper middle class upbringing. And what became clear to me early on, though, was that I was a big feeler caught in a world where feelings were not really okay unless they were happy ones and friendly ones. So if anything, my earliest life was characterized by feeling really big feelings and wanting to create. I was interested in the arts from really early on. And I would write, you know, like these really disturbing poems that would get me sent to the school therapist. And my creative and feeling parts didn't really have a place or anybody that felt comfortable mentoring me in those spaces. So that set the stage for me to find my way into the work that I ended up doing with Jennifer Fried and Rendy Friedman in Santa Barbara with AHA, doing social emotional learning. And that really was a key to my developing all of these things that I didn't really get to develop when I was young, and then a passion for helping others develop those same, I don't even know what to call them. I don't like the word skills. Skills sounds like, you know, like how to shoot a basketball, which is also great. But that's, you know, being socially intelligent and emotionally intelligent really does involve a set of skills. Mm-hmm. And almost none of us learn them when we're children. And our parents were, you know, my parents were just doing the best they could.
Right.
So that's been a huge influence on me. And Jennifer also was my astrology teacher. She is my astrology teacher. So I've been just assembling all these different these different frameworks for just understanding like how to human. Mm-hmm. I feel like I remember being a kid and it just being mystified by like, how do people do, how does this work? How do we connect with each other? How do we feel happy and content and safe in relationships? And that kind of became my life work. And now I'm a therapist too. That was my COVID project. I went back to school and got my master's, and I'm now an associate marriage and family therapist.
You said something so, well, you said a lot of things so interesting. I love that people's COVID project was like baking bread, and you're like, yeah, I just like, you know, went to get certified in therapy and now I'm a therapist. It's like, yeah. So can we say serious high performer right here that we're talking to? But I wanted to go back to what you were saying. Like, you know, it's interesting because you said my childhood was sort of uncharacteristically, like it wasn't remarkable, I think it's the word that you used. And, you know, the interesting thing is I think that we assume that unless there's some big T trauma or little T trauma, that it's unremarkable. But in fact, your childhood absolutely determined the course of your life because it was what you didn't have. And not, again, to your other point of to you saying your parents were doing the best they could. Yeah. Yes, I love that, right? There's not judgment there. It's not like, oh yeah, and you didn't meet my social emotional needs. No, they were doing the best that they could, but it directly informed the work that you're doing now. And so it doesn't have to be, and I love that this point, it doesn't have to be that somebody neglected you in a way that you didn't have financial means or you didn't have food on the table. It can be that they didn't have the bandwidth or tools or resources or know-it-all how to provide you the skills and the awareness of the importance of these things. And now in your work, you make sure or you help folks ensuring that they have these tools and resources to be able to human.
Yeah. And I has really impacted the way that I parent too. You know, I have five total, two came out of my body. And then I have three stepkids. So I've gotten to watch a bunch of kids grow up. And I really applied myself to this, like, this was the project of my life. I'm gonna learn everything I can about how to parent well. And that became a big part of what I was passionate about too. And what I want, the work that I want to do as a therapist and coach and is working with parents to sort of notice, okay, here's my conditioning. Here's how I was parented. And do I want to choose a different way? That's been really big. The other thing I do want to give my parents credit for one thing in particular, a lot of things. They really prioritized education. And I grew up in a house full of books, Broadway musicals on vinyl. And there was a lot of emphasis on learning as the path. And that definitely I have two siblings. I have a twin brother and I have an older sister, and all of us just became avid lifelong learners, which I think is like one of the best things you can give to your kid, a sense of the world is awesome and wonderful. And there's so much to learn. And, you know, before the internet, that was something.
That curiosity, my gosh, what a beautiful thing to impart on you. I mean, that is so much of life, right? Is that curiosity. And that's where everything sort of blooms from, that curiosity. And you said something else about parenting different than the way you were raised. And I think a lot of folks listening to this, including myself, similarly, amazing parents, did the best they could, provided a beautiful childhood for me and my three siblings, and did not provide social emotional, not skills, like awareness, or I don't even know how to define that, but tell me how you, because you made very clear, like, I parent differently. I've made it my job, my life, my mission to make sure that I don't sort of repeat the patterns of my parents in that regard. So I'm curious, like, what are some of the like critical things that you've done differently to be able to meet the social emotional needs of your children?
I was one of those nutty attachment parenting moms. So I did the whole thing. I had my children, I gave birth at home, which not everybody can do. I feel really privileged that I was able to do that. you know, I wore them on my body for the basically the until they wanted to get down. I slept with them. I nursed them on demand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So like that piece, I feel like set such an important foundation for what was to come. And, you know, it's controversial and not everybody can parent that way. I was lucky. I got to stay home and my work was from home at the time. So not everybody can do it that way. And I want to always acknowledge that I was fortunate enough to be able to meet their attachment needs or, you know, from the very beginning, without a lot of stress. So that piece was important. And, I want to shout out to my, I call her, my sister wife, Amanda Lake, who was my ex-husband's ex. So when I married my ex-husband, he had two boys with her. And she became like one of my closest people and an auntie to my kids when they came. So she introduced me to all of these concepts. So, and that's another thing too. I always feel so grateful to just stumble into the lives of people who give me such precious knowledge, and a big value for me is being open to it. Not thinking that I have it dialed. Like I'm always open for new information and new input. So then the other pieces are just around emotional intelligence, around talking about feelings, around welcoming all feelings, and allowing for children to learn how to self-soothe in that sort of dynamic where, like my daughter, I'll just tell a story. I'm trying to avoid telling a story, but I don't know why. So I'll just tell the story. You know, my daughter used to have these big meltdowns about homework, and she's really high strung, and she's 20, almost 23 now. And I would go to her and she would be flipping out, and I would like sit with her and I would really focus on the parts where she was calming down a little bit. I would acknowledge, wow, you're really upset. This is really hard for you. And I would touch her if she would let me, and just kind of wait for her to start to come out of it and then really lean in. Wow, you're really calming yourself down. You're coming out of it. Great work. You know, this is a really hard moment for you. So this is something that I learned from the nurtured heart approach, which is the parenting method that I have coached in and used with my children. And I discovered that when I was like, I don't know, when my son was 3 and he's 20 now. Mm-hmm. So that has been a really, that's one piece of it. There's 3 sort of interlocking pieces of it that all work together. But that piece has probably been the most important. And just anything that comes up for you, kiddo, you can tell me and I'm not going to freak out. That's
the piece, right? Because so how do you not like, so, okay. Yes, I would agree. I'm very much like speak what you're going through. Like, I want to know, I really want to create an environment. I think I have to a certain extent created an environment with my kids where we talk about everything. But I am not exempt from the reaction sometimes. And this, so how do I work through that? Or not only me, not just me. This isn't a therapy session. Everyone is like, yes. We work through that. Well,
it's such a great question because I do work, like I work with parent groups and then I work with a lot of parents individually. And that is the $1 million question. How? Okay. I know I'm not supposed to freak out, but how? So this is where the astrology part has come in so handy for me because I think there was a time when I felt a little judgmental of people who couldn't like keep their, you know what, together. I can say shit, who couldn't keep their shit together and who then were making the problem so much worse because of their reactivity and the kids pushing them away and they're going more underground and they're not talking to them even more. And what I learned, how are you, like, do you know about astrology? Do you have any astrology knowledge?
Yeah. I'm always sort of very intrigued. And I had a friend recently did the charts of my daughters. And so that was really helpful to get a sense of like their charts. But yeah, I'm an amateur. I would say that.
Okay. So the moon sign, it designates emotional needs and habits. So if you know somebody's moon sign, you can kind of understand like their level of reactivity. That's just something that's kind of fun to look at. And I'm going to put that on the side because that's kind of a specialized thing. But the other piece too is people who've had a lot of adversity, people who've had a lot of trauma, especially in their own childhoods with their own parents and families, their window of tolerance is smaller. You know, their ability to take in whatever's going on and not be reactive is less. And then on top of that, there's just, you know, this ties in with the astrology thing, but you can also just talk about it like temperament. People just have different temperaments. Some people are way more emotional, and that's beautiful. Like that's not bad. That's not wrong. Where that can come into play in a less helpful way is when, you know, your kid comes and says, "Hey, like I smoked my first joint last night," and you like flip your lid, or I'm ready to go to Planned Parenthood to get my birth control, flip your lid, right? So that always comes back to being more self-aware and just learning how to manage yourself, which is a whole other thing. To be a really effective parent, so much self-awareness is required. Understanding the things that trigger you, having places to go, people to talk to when that moment comes and you're like, oh my gosh, I feel my body just getting so, all the anxiety things are happening. My butterflies, my heart is pounding. I just heard something that's freaking me out. So instead of doing the thing where you get reactive with the kid, you say, you know what, sweetheart? Mom's having a minute of just feeling really overwhelmed. That was a big thing you told me, and I'm so glad you told me. And I'm going to go and just take care of myself for a little while. And we're going to come back and talk about this. And then you say when. So the kid's not just like, oh my gosh, this thing is hanging over my head. But that like, and to give so much appreciation for, thank you for telling me. And that strategy has been, I think, instrumental in helping me. I've stayed close to my children all the way through their adolescence. Like I've been able to be present. They talk to me about stuff. I mean, I'm sure there's stuff they haven't told me. Like, I'm not kidding myself. And our relationship is just so clear. The exchange is so clear. The other piece is that I try to have really clear boundaries and rules. And I've never punished them for anything, but it's more like, hey, that's the line, you're over it, let's correct this, and always saying something about it. So that piece, like you can be love, you know, all the love and the flow and the communication can be happening, and then we're really great friends. But then if I also don't have the clarity and the boundaries, that gets sloppy too.
Yeah. And it's not surprising that we are reactive, because when you said, you know, community, knowing what triggers you, feeling your body, right? Like you can, so many people are disembodied. And so like, they don't even know what's going on in their body. You know, I spent years completely detached from my body. And so to like, know like, oh, I'm feeling something, you know, like to know that it's because our body knows first, everyone. So to feel it in the body, to even be, oh, okay, hello, that's a signal. It's telling me something. That, you know, so many folks don't have those things, right? They don't have community. They don't have people to talk to. They're not even aware kind of what their triggers are, right? People don't do a lot of self-reflection work. People don't do a lot of like things that like, that could be helpful to know, so that when these triggers do present themselves, that they're prepared. And that, again, that feeling your body, and just like when we live outside of our bodies, that's a hard thing to feel your body. And so it's not surprising that, and then back to what you're saying about the reacting, and that when you have greater adversity or trauma, your window of tolerance is smaller. And so like just going into it, knowing, I think most folks have had some level of small or big T trauma in their lives, and like recognizing like, okay, that is going to contribute to the way I react and show up. And so, yeah, it's beautifully described, and those are beautiful things to be cognizant of. Cause I think if we could just, cause most, all those things are us, right? Those are things that we can manage, because we can't manage so much. We can't manage, but if we can kind of work on those things of like finding community, find people to talk to, doing some sort of self-reflection work and thinking about those things, I think we can show up as a better person, which in turn is going to mean showing up as a better parent.
Right. And that's such a good point, Sarah, that it's how we show up. That is the most important teaching for our children. Showing them that we can slow down. That's the other piece I always talk with people about. It's like everything in you when you're triggered wants to solve the problem.
Right.
And developing a practice of noticing the body, we call them body clues at AHA. When we teach this to kids. Mm-hmm. And taking that as a cue not to dive deeper into the problem, but to slow down, take a step back and calm yourself. And that in itself, like you're creating new neural pathways every time you do that. You're training yourself in a new habit. And having someone in your household, like maybe your partner, somebody who's co-parenting, or even like a friend to talk about these things with is super important. It's very hard to do it by yourself.
Yeah. I mean, the work that you do and teaching this is so, we're going to put everything in the show notes so that those of you listening that might need a little bit added support, guidance, like Melissa and the work that she does is for sure can provide you that. And I think the slowing down, I mean, I think the other thing that's really important to know is that we live in an environment, in a world where we're conditioned to go at a million miles per hour. In fact, we're celebrated for it. In fact, we're paid a lot of money for it. In fact, the people that, you know, the high performers are the ones that are being noticed. And so it's this like reckoning that's not, I mean, I also lived like that for many, many, many years. I went like 5 million miles per hour. And there's a lot of reasons why I would move 5 million miles per hour, but like recognizing that slowing down and that relearning and that inward look and allowing yourself the time for reflection and allowing the time for you just to pause, right? And say like, I need a minute. Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes people listening are like, oh, so I'm supposed to say that every time I get like triggered and it's like any muscle, right? The more you flex it, you, as Melissa said, there's new neurotransmitters that are being developed and your reaction to things are, you're learning a different path. You're carving a different pathway.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be a long pause. Sometimes it's just long enough to not have the first thing that you want to blurt come out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. To be more choiceful about what you say, about how you respond. Like it's reaction versus response. And sometimes reaction is totally called for, like safety first, people, yeah, right? Yeah. We don't want a whole bunch of people, you know, walking around in the world, managing their reactions to, you know, cars bearing down on them in the street, right? Or an emergency situation with your kid. You know, sometimes you've got to just get in there and do what you got to do. And then the other piece that I think has served so well is, let's say you do blow your top. Let's say you do get reactive and you say the things that you wish you hadn't said and your kid's like, whoa, or whoever in your world, you know, your coworker, your friend, your mother, you can go back and repair. Yeah. And that's another thing we don't do in our culture. Because if I say I have something to repair with you, that means that can I say the F word too? Oh, that means that I fucked up and that's not okay. Never. Yeah. We're not allowed to do that either. We're supposed to go 800 miles an hour all the time and never make a mistake.
Have all the answers.
Yes. So repair is another thing that we teach at AHA that I was actually looking at the surveys of the kids that we served in the spring. And I was really surprised to see that so many of them, the thing that they took away that was most helpful to them was this relational repair strategy that we taught them.
Which I love that.
Pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that's really cool. I call it a redo. So sometimes I'll like completely overreact. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I just want to redo that conversation. I want to redo my response. Can I do that? And my daughters will be so kind to let me. But what I also find sometimes what I do in this work as I continue to work on myself is that sometimes, like last week, I wanted to do something as a family. And I was like, let's go down to the lake and paddleboard. And I was like, Mom, like, can we just rest? Like, you always have to be on the go. I mean, there's a lot there. We could talk about that. But, and I just, you know, I got pissed. And my initial reaction was like, you know, fine, go sit in your fucking room and be on your phone for the next 5 hours in a dark dungeon and just like literally letting your mind, I didn't say all this, by the way, but it led me to my comment, right? So I go down this like crazy, crazy rabbit hole. And so then I am almost passive aggressive. I'm like, you know what? Fine. You do you. I do me. I'm going to go to the beach and paddleboard because that's what I want to do. You go do you. Mm-hmm. But it was like, I was a little passive aggressive in the saying what I said, I think is totally fine because I do believe, and I'm getting to this point of like, you know what? Like if people don't want to do what I do, my family specifically, it's okay. I mean, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's not a choice. We're all going out and doing this. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's like, no. I would love us as a family to do this. But if I get resistance, it's like, you know what? That's all right.
Yeah. Power struggles are the pits.
With the pits.
Yeah.
So I feel like I just want people to have permission to be like, also, it doesn't have to be this like fucking perfect picture of like, okay, we're all going to go to the beach and paddle. Cause you know what? Then I take my kids out. Cause I say, we're all going to go to dinner and then they're resentful and then they're not kind. And then, you know, that presents a different outcome. Then I'm pissed. Then the whole experience is ruined. Cause no one, you know, so I feel like that mindfulness and like that being okay. And acceptance of like, there are going to be times that we all aren't going to want to do the same things. And know that you have this ability to just go and do your own, do you.
Yeah. Yeah. How old are your kids again?
15 and 13.
13. Okay. How's it going with the devices? Are you having a hard time with the...
Well, you know, we have some rules around devices and they're at camp for the next 6 weeks without devices, which I think is like so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a struggle. I think that we have some rules, but I think sometimes those rules get violated. And I just worry, you know, I think like the rest of the world, but truth be told, Melissa, I'm worried about my own consumption of technology. Uh-huh. So, it's like, it's a whole experiment of looking into like in general, like I said to my husband last night, I was like, we should give up phones for 6 weeks. Like, what if we just came home at night and like observed the Sabbath and didn't touch our stuff until, you know, the next day when we headed out to work. Right. Like, I think that it's something I might try and hold myself to.
Yeah. What a great idea. Like a intermittent fasting, but with your phone.
Right. Right. Like, and just let people know, like, if you need me, call me. If it's urgent, call me. Huh. And so maybe I do that out of, you know, when they put the text, when you get the automatic, like I'm driving, I can't speak right now. Maybe I just say like, I'm observing the Sabbath, the phone Sabbath. Like,
I think you are so onto something with this.
Yeah.
I'm serious. This is such a great idea because we can't put them away. We can't take them away from kids because then they're out of the loop.
Right.
Like, I don't know if you've been following the research, but at this point taking the phone away from a child is actually just as bad for their mental health as them being on it too much.
I know. That's what, you know, that was a mistake we made because one of my daughters made a really bad decision. And the only thing that gets a reaction out of her is the phone.
It's a go-to for most parents. It's like, that's the only thing that they...
That's the only thing. They're like, they don't care. Like they literally could take everything else away. But then, you know, we reacted and we took it away. And then we were like, oh my God, I didn't even need to look at any research, but I was just like, I knew it wasn't the right. That's not going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. I knew that was not the solution. But yeah, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me at all because it's in like the parents that are like, I'm holding off and their kid's like 15 and everybody's connected this way. And this kid feels completely disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like I'm not, there's no judgment. I just think I would imagine that would probably be really hard and difficult for all parties involved. Yeah. So I don't know what the solution is, by the way, everyone listening, like
me neither.
I do not know the solution. So I'm not passing judgment for sure on anybody or any decisions, but I do know that I did experience that I was like, holy shit, that was the wrong choice. Like, let's give the phone back. And then, you know, we made some different changes, but.
Yeah. It's really like the Wild West right now. We have no idea how to manage this. Our children are androids and we are too, to some extent, but not like they are. They're part machine.
Yeah.
and I've really worked on just getting okay with that and then saying, okay, then what? Then how do we be? And for my kids, it was taking time away, like going backpacking, being in nature, where they just remember what it's like to not be an android. And we have a thing at AHA that we just had our third year of a digital cleanse, where we take this year it's 26 kids to El Capitan Canyon, which is kind of, it's not very rugged. It's like a beautiful sort of resort with cabins. And we take away their phones for 5 days. It's really amazing what happens as they remember their most human parts start to come through. And but an intermittent, you know, the thing about taking the phone away from the kid at 9 p.m. and then you get it back, you know, when you're ready for school, I'll give it back to you in the morning, so that they have those alternating experiences of, okay, here's me connected and here's me not connected. That I think is really, that's going to be the only way to.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that I love the idea when, and for them, it's been camp where every year there's some designated time that they're actually, and I think I just had a retreat this spring. And, you know, before the retreat, I sent an email out and just like, want to manage expectations, want to manage your family's expectations, like you, what your boundaries and what you decide what those are, right? Like, do you want to be technology free all weekend? Here's the landline of the number of the place. If you want to go technology free so that you don't have to have this pressure to check your phone, da, da, da. And so many people said how grateful they were to say, and I said, use me, say like, it's a technology free weekend. I don't care. Use me as an excuse, mm-hmm. but like this freedom. And I too feel like this freedom of like all the, just freeing yourself of all the distractions in life to really focus on the being mm-hmm. and the present. And it's such a gift that you're giving yourself, because I literally just walked out of a coaching session and it was like, we fill our life with distraction to keep us from looking at the things we need to look at the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Oh,
yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And have you ever heard that Brené Brown term about foreboding joy?
Oh, tell me more.
So, you know, she wrote her whole book on emotions. It's a beautiful book. And yep. She talked about joy being really triggering for some people, mm-hmm. being happy and being content. And there, it's that whole thing of, okay, when is the shoe going to drop? What's going to hit me upside the head when I'm relaxed and chilling and not looking? And I think, I know for me, I just came through a super, super over busy period. I got very sick. And that was the thing that made me, okay, I have to change what I'm doing. And I got a sickness that wasn't like, there's no long lasting effects. It wasn't COVID. I got viral meningitis, which is like, who gets that? That's just weird. So I landed in the hospital and then afterwards I was like, okay, I really need to simplify my life. And then I didn't really figure out how. And then another week went by and I was back in the hospital and I was like, oh, okay. So I quit one of my jobs. I had two jobs. I quit one job. And since then I've had all this space. And I'm really noticing how the space creates a lot of anxiety. And I don't think I'm alone in that, you know, go-getter, overachiever people who go to, you know, get their master's degree during COVID. Having that open space to just be, I've had to really sit with a lot of anxiety. So I'm imagining that might be true for a lot of the people that you work with too. And maybe even for you.
Absolutely. And I'm just curious, like, how do you, because that's something people want to avoid, right? You want to avoid the discomfort. And so in this coaching session, like that's exactly was the aha of like, you realize why you're all in on work. You realize that, right? You realize that there's a point why we are all in so that we don't have to focus on this. When they do focus on this, like, you know, I'm curious what your approach is. I mean, certainly there's lots of approaches of how you can sit with this discomfort, and there's lots of people, right? Therapists, you have the work that you're doing. There's a lot of people that you can sit with to help you get through it as well. But for me, I think it's like any muscle in that it's, you know, a slowly built muscle of strength to sit in this space. And so, you know, I don't recommend sitting in this space for an hour, you know, don't give yourself an hour. That's to mm-hmm. me, it's like, way too much. You're setting yourself up for failure. I think it's, you know, a really bad idea. If you're not doing anything, mind you, So like 0 to 60, right? So it's like just giving yourself of this like 5 minute window of thinking about, you know, your feelings, letting yourself feel. And then I like to always think about how do you want to feel? Because I think like part of it is like people don't even know how they want to feel.
Right.
And so they're just like in the feedback loop of our brain, our thoughts of this negativity oftentimes, that it's like, okay, you know, that's there. Well, what would you want to be there instead?
Yeah, that's great. I think for me, it's somatic.
Yeah.
The anxiety has a somatic sort of substrate. It feels a certain way in my body. It'll probably feel a little bit different in your body. And to actually dial into the sensations and how they're moving without even necessarily labeling it. Like, oh, there's some energy moving here. And it feels kind of yellow and kind of like electric. And it's in my tummy. And I'm just going to sit with that and just notice it and not call it bad. This just is. And discomfort, our system is actually really beautifully designed to get away from discomfort. Like that's what our system wants to do. And just the way life is now, I think we're being called to sit with discomfort a lot more and to not medicate it with all the things, including screens that we medicate it with. And the lore is, and I'm not sure if there's any actual research on this, I should check, but that if you actually sit with a feeling, it will move through you pretty quickly. If you don't take the rumination part into the equation,
right?
Don't conflate right. thoughts with your feelings.
Right.
One of the influences that I had in my early 40s was I joined a women's group. There's a thing called Mankind Project. I don't know if you have it where you are, probably not in New York, but it's sort of, they have this big workshop where they discover themselves and they cry and they do all the manly things. And then they have a rite of passage and then they form a group. And the women in these men's lives were like, this is cool. We want to do this too. And so they started to form women's groups that are sort of based on the same structure. And this was my first real experience sitting in a real group, in a process group. And we had this thing where we would talk about our thoughts and our feelings, and the thoughts we said, the stories we're telling ourselves. Like, I feel anxious. The story I'm telling myself is that I have too many things to do today and I'm not going to get them all done. And that means I'm a bad person and that I'm a failure and that I should never try to do anything. Like, so separating out the feelings from the stories. And then there's also just the facts. Like, is my list too fucking long? Well, yes. The fact is that there are more things on this list than I can do today. So for me, parsing those things out also really helps me to just isolate, okay, here's a feeling state I just need to sit, either tolerate or sit with or something. And then I'll do the other things I need to do. And I'm not going to whip up the torment with my thoughts. Because my thoughts lie a lot.
Absolutely. Yes. Your thoughts are liars for sure. And yeah, I'm reading this book and it talks about thoughts and how your ego talks in the first person. And so those thoughts, we assume they're real.
Mm-hmm.
If you added an external person saying those thoughts to you, you would fact check it, right? Like if somebody right. said, there'd be a fact checking process and like mm-hmm. there's no fact checking. And then that all the assumptions we then put to the thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fat, therefore I'm not worthy, therefore I'm not happy. I can't have happiness because I'm fat. I'm not worthy. I'm not enough. I don't have this because of my body. Like there's all these assumptions that we're putting on that are, so yeah, thoughts are, it's, I love that you make that point. That the sitting in that, recognizing that things will move through you rather quickly and ruminating about it is certainly not helping anything. And if any, it's only making it worse, of course, as we know. And so as uncomfortable as it would be to sit and let it work itself through you, it's that much more, it wreaks that much more havoc on you, right? To sit and ruminate and allow those thoughts to continue to just fester and that feedback loop to get stronger and stronger and stronger.
One thing I learned recently is that human beings' first go-to when they're when they're triggered, when they're overwhelmed, is connection. There's a lot of sort of belief systems around, I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to make sure that I don't show up in relationship a mess. And I'm, you know, if I'm not feeling 100% perfection, I'm going to go and like work on myself until I am. And then I can go do all the things with all the people. But I think we're being called on right now, especially to turn towards each other. So in that anxious feeling, in that anxious moment, I might actually want to crawl into my bed and not talk to anybody. But what really will help me is to connect with another person and let that resource me and talk about what's, oh gosh, I'm feeling super anxious. Story I tell myself is that blah, 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 blah. And to be able to also like fact check things with people. Because sometimes our stories feel so true and we need other people to sort of fact check us like, dude, no, here's all the reasons why this is not a true story. And to be the person that somebody comes to with that is such a beautiful thing. Everybody wants to be that person for somebody else.
Find a fact checker. That's what, if you're listening, your CTA from this is find a fact checker. Find someone that you can have in your life. And as Melissa said, people want to be that person, right? People want to be that for somebody else. I say this all the time, especially for women when they want something or they're afraid to ask for it because I don't want to come across as needy or like, I don't want to put someone in a bad position. And I always say like, you are robbing them of the opportunity to serve you. Mm-hmm. Most people want to serve.
Yeah. And I have one friend, we probably all have friends like this who's really good at this. She's so good at it that she asks for reassurance a lot. And initially I was like, that's a lot of reassurance, and felt a little bit prickly about it. But then I just realized all she needs me to do is just reassure her every single time. I don't have to do it any particular way. I don't have to like make it interesting every time. She just needs a lot of reassurance, and some people do. And so she's my friend and I'm going to do that for her. And that's like an explicit expectation she has in her friendships. Like I'm a mess a lot and I'm going to need reassurance a lot. Is that okay with you? Okay. Yeah. I'll let you know if it ever gets to be too much.
Yeah. And I think that's a beautiful point to make because we also set these expectations on friendships without actually talking about them. Right. I think in life, right? Like it's like, you're a mind reader, Melissa, you should know that this is what I need. And like, ask the person, right? Like, this is what I need. Are you able to deliver? And it's okay that the person says no. Yeah. Right. No is okay. It's a full sentence, right? Like it's okay to say, this is not about you. It is about the person's bandwidth. It's about the person. It's about, you know, it's their, you know, so stop making it about you and recognize that like, there's another person out there that can be that person, but don't just expect that Melissa's going to be that person without having a conversation that she's willing to be that person.
Yeah. One of the things that I love talking with people about is implicit versus explicit expectations. Implicit expectations are the things that ruin relationships. I think you're supposed to read my mind. You're supposed to know what I need because it's what you need, but it's maybe not the same thing that I need. So let's talk about it. Like, let's be really clear about our expectations in relationship. And to do it you can totally be like, well, if you really loved me, you would know that I needed blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I need my feet rubbed for 26.3 minutes every Wednesday. And you should know that. But to really assume, and this is a parenting piece too, that has been so helpful for me. Don't assume that they know anything,
right?
Especially about you and what you need, because it's just like, it takes such a load off. They should know how to wash the dishes. They should know how to do their laundry. They should know how to rub my feet. No, you got to tell them. And it's a hard sort of crick in the road to get past if you are really still in that fantasy land of like, if they really loved me, they would know. But it just, it's not true.
Not true. It's not true. Thank you so much for for that point. And I think it's a beautiful point to end on. I don't want to end. I'd love to continue talking, but I will honor
you. You've been all over the place. Holy
I love it. That's what I said. I said, this conversation goes in so many different directions and I love all the directions it goes. There's so many golden nuggets, I think, that were dropped and that people, I think, can really relate to and really actionable steps that people can take, which I really appreciate. I think it makes for good listening when you're able to say like, oh God, I'm going to try that. Or that's something I might've forgotten that I need to sort of resuscitate. So thank you so much for just being here and sharing your gifts with us. And before you go, I wanted to do just a quick lightning round and it's just a little easy breezy, this or that. Okay. So okay. Don't need to think too hard. Just like this or that. All right. Kindle or book?
Book.
Bath or shower?
Bath.
Dog or cat?
Cat.
Sunrise or sunset?
Sunrise.
Night on the town or cozying on the couch with a book?
Couch with a book.
And is there any book that lives on your bedside table or that you're currently reading that we need to know about?
Well, I always have way too many books on my bedside table, but the one that is on top of the stack is Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey, What Happened to You? Do you know this book? Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's all about trauma and healing. And Bruce Perry is this amazing neuroscientist and Oprah Winfrey like dug him out of the lab and threw him into the limelight. And he's just lovely.
Love that. I actually think I saw a video on like one of the socials that I think was them talking. Now that I'm thinking
about it. It's a really quick read too. Lots of stories.
Oh, good. I love when they have stories. Any podcast that you listen to on the regular?
I love, there's a podcast called Therapist Uncensored, which is a couple of therapists in Austin, Texas. And it's for anybody. You don't have to be a therapist to listen to it. If you're interested, they call the people who subscribe neuro nerds, people who are just interested in personal growth and strategies like the ones that we've been talking about. They have really interesting guests. And I also love This American Life and The Moth.
The Moth. Oh yeah. So good.
Telling podcasts.
Yeah. All so good. We'll drop them in the show notes. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you again for being here. I'm so grateful for your time.
Sarah, this was really fun. I just feel so like I'm quelling that you even asked me.
Well, I am so glad that our orbits collided and that you said yes. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please reach out to Melissa if you have any further questions or you're like, hey, I could probably use her support. She's a good resource for sure. Thank you again, Melissa, for being here. And thank you everyone for tuning in to Below the Surface at the Now. And until next time, everybody, be well.